Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a Lip Media Podcast.
Sit, boo boo, sit, boo boo, sit.
Girl,
good dog.
That's some bad hat hair.
It's a cool show.
Did you get any of that?
Not a doctor.
Bye, have a good hug
from your mom.
Clarp, no, we're about to clarp, no, we're about to.
Hello and welcome to Hunting Seasons, the podcast that dares to binge watch, deep dive and break down a season of television each and every episode. I'm Broderick Gordis.
I'm Damask Leary.
And today we'll finally be discussing Lovecraft Country Season 1. Damask Leary, where the fuck have you been?
I don't know. A void somewhere. The things I've seen. I can now name myself. I don't know. Just been hanging out with my cat, who's very, very sick.
Very
poor
sick.
Poor girl.
I knew she was very sick. You explained to me today just how sick she was.
Yeah,
was
poor girl is blind now. Skin and bones. She's on her way out, but she's chugging along. So I spent about 2 to 3 weeks sleeping on the floor with her in the spare room because the poor dear didn't know where she was. So she's doing better now. But yes, it's just kind of hospice care at this point, poor dear.
That's sad. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. These things happen.
How long have you had Mal for now?
I think I got her when she was 7 and she's 13 now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Poor thing.
Yeah.
She's a good cat too.
She is.
What else has been happening? Anything exciting? Anything to announce?
Just, you know, the beginning of a new life again.
Mm.
We are face to face.
Isn't that nice?
I'm in your new house.
Yes, welcome.
Which I only saw for the first time the other day when we had our first, like, in-person D&D game for the entire year, right?
Did we have one? I think we had one. No, we had one in May as well.
Did we?
Yeah, people came down to May for like 2 weeks. We're like, slotted one in real quick.
Right.
We haven't had one since
that
then.
That desperate look in our eyes. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so that was really, really lovely. So just kind of being able to go to people's houses again, eat out at restaurants, which is fabulous. When I've got the money, because I still don't have a job. But thank you, the tiny crumbs I'm getting from JobKeeper are still coming through, which is good.
That's good.
I shouldn't complain to international listeners who are getting little to no support.
That's true.
But no, other than that, just kind of really quite happy that things are almost back to normal. Yeah.
Do genuinely feel for people in the Northern Hemisphere at the moment, though, who are heading into their winter and their Christmas, and things seem to be getting worse, not better, in a lot of ways. We've endured these lockdowns and they suck, but also worth it. Like,
because we did have lockdown in winter, but it's not Christmas time, so
nothing happens
here in winter.
I think we missed the comedy festival, and
that's in March.
That didn't happen too, though. But like that, what happens in winter here? The football. I miss down the football. Love the footy. It's not Christmas though.
Like, you couldn't go to a game, but you still kind of had football.
That's a good point. I could still watch it.
Yeah.
I suppose the same way you can watch your family dinner over Zoom.
Yeah. So what are you complaining about up there? Yeah. No. It's very sad.
Can you tell I'm being sympathetic? Is that not coming across? I'm sorry.
No, because this will be my last Chrissy in Melbourne because I'll be moving to Perth sometime next year. So I'm glad that things have cleared up for now. Who knows what's going to happen? But so I'll be able to have Christmas with the people I love.
That will be good. Looking forward to that. All right, let's not delay any longer and get to our spoiler-free review of Lovecraft Country Season 1.
Let me clue you in.
Season in review.
Lovecraft Country is an American horror drama television series developed by Misha Green, writer on Heroes, Sons of Anarchy, and Spartacus, and produced by Monkey Paw Productions, founded by Jordan Peele of Key & Peele, Get Out, and Us fame, and is based on the 2016 novel of the same name by Matt Ruff. The show follows Atticus Freeman as he joins up with his friend Letitia and his uncle George to embark on a road trip across 1950s Jim Crow America in search of his missing father while surviving both the racist terrors of white America America and the terrifying monsters that could be ripped from a Lovecraft paperback. The show stars Jurnee Smollett, Jonathan Majors, Anjanou Ellis, Courtney B. Vance, Wunmi Mosaku, Abby Lee, Jamie Chung, Jada Harris, and Michael K. Williams, and premiered on HBO on August 16th, 2020. Season 1 consists of 10 episodes, each coming in at around 56 minutes, and took us approximately 9 hours and 25 minutes to watch. So before we get to our review, Damask, how familiar are you with the work of H.P. Lovecraft? And of course, the Matt Ruff book, Lovecraft Country. Matt Ruff book, Lovecraft Country. And maybe even the previous works of Misha Green and Jordan Peele.
So well, that was four questions. To answer your question, as you were asking me that, I was like, oh, yeah, I've read Journey to the Center of the Earth, but I'm quite sure that was Jules Verne.
That's definitely so Lovecraft.
That's how familiar I am with any of those things. Sure. Yeah, yeah. Not at all. Not at all. I watched Get Out, Jordan Peele's thing, yes. And I used to watch Key and Peele. I was going to say Misha Green, but that's not right, is it? I was thinking of the guy from Supernatural. That's sorry, I'm all over the place. Haven't watched any of it, but I was looking up Underground, and I was like, I actually do want to watch that show. I haven't. That's Misha Green's thing before this.
Yep.
But yeah, little to no knowledge. Why I say little. No knowledge over here, Brian. What about you?
H.P. Lovecraft is a weird one. I've not read any of his books or anything like that, but there is an influence on society and pop culture from Lovecraft that I'm familiar with. Cthulhu is an entity that I'm aware of. There was the Penny Arcade, the Rain Slick Precipice of Darkness was the name of the game series that was sort of...
Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
It does. It's actually a great title, but it is hard to say. That was very Lovecraft inspired. That's probably the most time I've spent inside anything that's even vaguely Lovecraft. Mm. I think Mind Flayers and D&D are kind of Lovecraftian as well. Things like that. So it's more the echoes of Lovecraft than anything specific. Even South Park, I think Cthulhu has been in, was it one of the games or there's an episode that involves Cartman as one of his superheroes or something like that. Anyway, things like that. Mm. In terms of Misha Green and Jordan Peele, I've watched Heroes and a few of the other things she's been involved with. But Jordan Peele's probably the big one. Obviously, Get Out, which I loved. Us, which I thought was decent. I haven't seen his Twilight Zone stuff, though. Although I think he was more hosting and executive producing. I don't know how creatively involved he was in that as well. Even with this, it's like exactly how creatively involved he is, I'm not sure. But certainly... I understand his influence on getting like African-American voices in pop culture, in horror in particular recently, has really, really been influential. So that's been cool. So I'm familiar with that to that degree. So never read the book by Matt Ruff or any Lovecraft stuff though. With all that said, Damask, would you like to give your spoiler-free review of Lovecraft Country Season 1?
Sure, why not? It's been long enough. I've prepared something.
The people have waited.
Oh, they've cried for it. Cried for it. Okay, here we go. This show is Nutball's Banana Pants. It is pulpy in its intention and execution. Each episode brings a new adventure, which feels super fun. However, sometimes the quick change between genres leaves the character experience behind. I can see why some might not be interested in this, and that's fair enough. It can feel disorientating. Is that right? Disorienting? Disorientating?
Yep, sure. Let's go with that.
Let's not decide on anything. All right. But I was compelled by the majority of the stories that were told. The world is weird. Sometimes I wasn't really clear on how our characters got the information they needed in order to jump to the next point of the adventure. But to be honest with you, I didn't really care. I just wanted to get to wherever they were going. The cast is also fabulous. There is a lot of talent on screen, and while the show is more plot heavy than character focused, the performances allowed for a lot of attachment on my part. I wanted everyone to survive and destroy the big bad. Also, they are very, very beautiful, and I am into it. I found each part of the story pretty strong. However, it's the stitching together of those parts that is the most underwhelming in the show. Along the way, I got the vibe that I wanted to sit in the horror sci-fi moments of the week rather than get clues about the bigger mystery of the story. And that was proven absolutely true when the show ended. I had a great time along the way, but didn't feel satisfied by the ending. I think the aspirations of the narrative were a little too unruly and unmanageable by the end. I've watched this show twice now, and I actually enjoyed it more the second time around. I think it's a fun horror adventure series that I will happily go back to time and time again. Now, I am a white woman. I am certainly not qualified or informed enough to comment on the appropriateness or effectiveness of the molding of pulpy-style storytelling with the trauma experienced by black people in America. I did, however, read a great article on TheRinger.com by Lex Pryor about just that, and I encourage everyone to head there and read it. It's called Lovecraft Country Was Undeniably Flawed. Maybe that's the point. And that's, once again, on The Ringer. So check that out, and I'm sure Brod will put it in the show notes. In summary, this show was a lot of fun to watch. I didn't realize how much I wanted a crazy adventure sci-fi fantasy series that was crammed full of narrative surprises that had me in each episode saying, "What the fuck just happened?" It's not perfect, but I didn't need it to be. The ride was fun enough. I really did love it. Brod, over to you.
Okay. Stop me if this sounds familiar, but Lovecraft Country Season 1 starts out with lots of promise and a heap of ideas, but for one reason or another, struggles to execute over its 10-episode run. We've done this before with similar high-concept shows. I was fully on board after its excellent pilot. It was fun, an engaging concept, strong characters, great performances, effective, if not subtle, commentary and themes, lots of style and some clever twists on familiar concepts. But then it needed to make a full season. Lovecraft Country Season 1 is a show of buts. For all its positives,
those buts.
There are just as many negatives. From a style perspective, it has it in spades. It's well shot, with great period sets and costumes, a fun mix of modern and period soundtrack, impressive visual effects, especially for TV, exactly what you would want from a show of this type. It even goes a step further with clever twists on tropes, such as a road trip montage, punctuated not by music, but by speeches on race relations, and impressive single-take tracking shots through crowds and action sequences. It understands and fully utilizes the Lovecraftian horror as metaphor for widespread, life-threatening racism. But the show struggles to pull all these individual strong elements into a cohesive, comprehensive narrative.
Mm.
To its credit, it's trying something ambitious, with each episode being very different from the next, with big new ideas and even genre shifts, whilst also trying to be a serialized story, but leans way stronger into the former at the expense of the latter. What's already confusing and convoluted is exacerbated by clunky flow, including weird jump cuts in time, not seeing and just hearing about seemingly key events, and just generally odd pacing overall. Then again, if you're here for some visually spectacular and graphic horror, then you're in the right place. The show has some of the most gruesome and confronting body mutilation I have ever seen, including close-up decapitations and buckets of shredded flesh and blood. But what works to begin with loses its impact as the violence becomes trivial. Not just because it is frequent, but because our characters stop reacting to it, and some of them even participate in it with very little reaction to it. Across the board, performances are great. I really liked everyone, but was especially impressed with Jonathan Majors, who plays Atticus, and Wunmi Masaku, who plays Ruby. But
oh God.
I told you, it's a show of butts. While the actors give it their all, their characters are let down by a pulpy story and serviceable but overall average writing. Yes, pulpy is stylistically appropriate, but everything is so serious. At least have some fun and humor alongside the dozens of secrets and soap operatic revelations. Most frustrating of all, though, this show is full of weird, wonderful, dazzling, and imaginative ideas, but they try to pack so much in that there just isn't enough space or follow through to make them all work together. Even going so far as to introduce multiple characters and ideas that seem important or at least interesting and then just get cut short, abandoned or forgotten about entirely. As I got deeper into the season, I tried to figure out what other shows Lovecraft Country reminded me of, and finally it hit me that shared some of the same sins as American Gods. Not as bad as American Gods.
Thank you for clarifying that.
It's important. But a lesser version of the strong visuals, themes, and performances with a major narrative and character problem. Ultimately, Lovecraft Country Season 1 is kind of like the magic talked about ad nauseum within the show. Impressive and powerful when you get all the ingredients right, but relies on a delicate balance that, when off, blows up in your face and ends in a big mess. Damask, how would you score this season out of 5 stars?
I give it a 3.5.
I'm not too far off. I'm giving it a 3. There is enough strong elements that I wouldn't say I'd recommend the show, but I think there are people who are going to find something to enjoy. What you're saying about watching a second time and getting more out of it, maybe I would have too. It's just frustrated me so much at times that it's hard for me to want to go back to it. But there's enough strong stuff here from performances and visuals and ideas that deserves to be a pass mark. But man, really, just as it went on, I was just like, what the fuck is going on this show?
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Before we dive into spoilers, we'd like to ask everyone who enjoys the show to please review us on Apple Podcasts. Nothing helps the show to grow more than by throwing 5 stars and maybe a couple of nice words our way.
And to sweeten the deal, if we reach 25 written reviews on Apple Podcasts, we will finally review Buffy the Vampire Slayer Season 1.
We would also love you to share hunting seasons with all the cool people you hang out with, not any of those losers, just in case they might like listening too.
Next week, we'll be back with our review of The Queen's Gambit Season 1. If you'd like to contribute to our discussion of The Queen's Gambit, or if you have any thoughts on Lovecraft Country, you can write to us or send us an audio recording that we may include in a future episode to contact at huntingseasonspodcast.com or find us on Twitter at huntingscast. But right now, let's talk spoilers for Lovecraft Country Season 1.
You're now entering the spoiler zone.
Spoiler warning. From here on, we'll be discussing everything that happens in Season 1 of Lovecraft Country. Before listening any further, we recommend watching all of Lovecraft Country up to this point. If you've not yet done so, proceed with caution. There are spoilers ahead.
You have been warned.
Kids, I'm going to tell you an incredible story.
Storytime with Damask.
I have decided to bring back the award-winning and much-celebrated segment called Storytime with Damask, and I'm so glad I decided to do it on an episode in which I barely understand or remember the plot of the show we're reviewing. Just another example of the great choices I make in life. You're welcome. All right, so we're in Chicago in the 50s. Now it's the 1950s to be exact. And in case you're wondering why that wouldn't need clarifying, holy jeez, just wait for it. So that's where we are, and a Korean war vet named Atticus is returning home because his dad has gone missing. So he visits his uncle and aunt who run a travel book publishing house, I guess. This whole family is a bunch of sci-fi nerds, and you love to see it. So Atticus, his uncle George, and his childhood friend Letty head off to Massachusetts because that's where they think Papa might be. Don't ask me how they come to that conclusion. I never know how our characters know things. I was drunk when I watched, and I'm sorry for that, but now after listening to Brod's review, I realise it's not me.
I think from memory he left him a note. that told him that his family secret was going to be...
No, I don't want to hear it. It's not my fault.
Okay.
So they head there. They encounter evil racist cops. So, you know, regular cops. Lulz, political, but not really. It's just reality. Anyway, these mean cops chase them through the forest. But before they get killed, some giant Rottweilers that have escaped from the local dogfighting ring attack everyone. But wait, they're not roided up dogs. Uncle George and Atticus are such super nerds that they recognize the beast's characteristics of those from their storybooks. Turns out reading is cool, kids. And they figure out the beasties hate light. Nice. While they fight off the hellhounds, Letty reveals herself to be Chicago's own Kathy Freeman and runs at the speed of light to their car and brings it back to save the day. Woohoo! Everyone is saved. Then the trio comes upon a mansion that is inhabited by people entirely devoid of pigment. Looks like my family reunion. Because there's blonde people, and then there are translucent psychopaths. Turns out they're a super rich family that got super rich from slavery and believe themselves to be the direct descendants of Gandalf the Aryan. Atticus' great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother was a slave in the house and was raped by the owner of the house. She lit the shit on fire, though, and made a run for it with a secret and very important book. But we'll come back to that later. Maybe. I may not remember it. Who knows? We'll see what happens later on. Anyway, turns out the man of the house and his glowing, ethereal fetus of a daughter want to cut Atticus up and use his blood for a spell that grants the dad eternal life. Atticus, George, and Letty all say fuck no to that. The house explodes. They manage to free Montrose, Atticus' father, and run away. But not before Uncle George dies. It is sad. Also, I forgot to mention that Letty was shot and on the verge of death, but Atticus agreed to participate in the spell to save her. Is that right? Sure, it feels right. So she's pulled a full Buffy season 6, except Letty seems happier about it. When they get back to Chicago, Letty has a spring in her step and buys a house. Oh, it feels nice to own property. She wants to turn it into a boarding house with the help of her sister Ruby. Too bad it's haunted. Dang it. Christina, the glowing fetus, asks Atticus for help finding some random pages from an ancient baby name book. It's important for a spell or some shit. Letty banishes the ghost with the power of being a badass. Turns out the house was built by another old white racist guy, but aren't they all? Montrose finds out the pages from the ancient baby name book are beneath a museum, so the gang does a national treasure into the building. They find the pages as well as a frozen two-spirit person who can help them decipher it. Except Montrose absolutely loses his shit and kills that person. Good going, Montrose. I see that velvet rage is working a treat. Meanwhile, Hippolyta and Dee are off following clues about George's death because they absolutely do not buy the bullshit story they've been told. Also, Ruby meets a white man called William who, spoiler alert, turns out to be Christina in necromancy drag. Christina, in drag, gives Ruby a magical potion that turns her into a white woman. It is very bloody and very gross, but also kinda gay. So I have confusing feelings about it. I have no further comment at this time. Then we go back in time to Korea and meet Jiha, who is very cool but also very sad because she is a Kumiho. She falls in love with Atticus. He bails on her when he discovers she's got murderous tails though, which boo, you're weak Atticus, and Jiha deserves better. Also, she sees his future, and apparently he's gonna die if he goes back to Chicago. Uh-oh. Back in the present, or the 50s, whatever, back to the main timeline, Hippolyta is following the clues of George's death. She discovers a multiverse time machine. Some more evil cops find her, and then she shoots one in a scuffle. Atticus throws another into a portal, and then Hippolyta is sucked up too. She's transported to an Afro-futuristic Amazeballs universe that I am very invested in. More please, more please. She's given the opportunity of experiencing possibility, which until that time had been entirely denied her. And it is so fucking cool. I loved it. Was everyone filled with absolute glee? Because you should have been. She sees more than any human could imagine, living in an infinity of lives across multiple universes and comes to a place where she is able to name herself. She is a discoverer. Well, all that shit is cool. She knows she's got to go home and be with Dee. Back to 50 Chicago, and we are at Emmett Till's funeral. No jokes. None. It is full on for every character, but particularly for Dee, who is friends with Emmett. She, understandably so, is distraught by what has happened, but also at the disappearance of her mum. While she wanders the streets, evil cops come and spit a curse onto her, and then she is tormented by two evil minstrel characters that had me shitting in my own dacks. The only way to break the curse is if she gives the evil head cop a golden diorama of planets that Hippolyta found. Dee tells them to fuck themselves and decides to deal with the evil spirits herself. She does pretty well, certainly better than I would, but ultimately she succumbs. Meanwhile, GR is back and all like, I told you you were in trouble, and also I deserve an apology, which thankfully Atticus gives, and I'd like all my exes to watch that scene and give me a call. I am waiting. Letty took some photos of the baby name book that they found in the museum and gives them to Christina in exchange for a protection spell. Now she can't die, which is super helpful. Also, Atticus does a protection spell, which comes in handy when the evil cops come to shoot up their house. Also, Ruby is still hanging out and canoodling with Christina, and I'm usually totally up for any queer situation, but Ruby, in the great words of Oda Mae Brown, you in danger, girl. Hippolyta comes back and Christina helps lift Dee's curse, kinda. Yes, there's a lot happening. Moving forward, the gang still needs to get the baby name book, though, so they decide to use the multiverse machine and go back to Tulsa 1921 to get it. Did they need to go back to the precise day of the Tulsa massacre to get it?
Yeah, did they?
I mean, no, but then if they didn't, I guess Atticus wouldn't be there to save his dad, so who knows? Time travel hurts my brain, and I don't want to talk about it anymore. Meanwhile, Letty manages to get the book from Atticus' grandma, and they all hop back to the main timeline. Yay. All right. Atticus and Letty get sucked into a flaming upside down while using the baby book to totally cure Dee. There they hang out with Atticus' ancestors. They all tell him to kick ass. Atticus summons the evil white ancestor to nom nom on some racist flesh, which is going to help his spell, apparently. Letty begs Ruby to dump her toxic girlfriend and help them by stealing some of her white wisps she calls hair. Ruby says no, but actually, turns out she does help them. But Christina finds out and kills her. And then Christina disguises herself as Ruby and comes along for an adventure. That sucks. Very sad. I haven't recovered. R.I.P. Ruby. When Letty finds out, she is pissed and fights Christina. She loses, though, by way of Bran Stark. But don't fret, she comes back to life and is voted ruler of King's Landing. Jokes. Anyway, Christina is doing her evil spell. She starts draining poor Atticus. Looks like everything is very bad. But then GR saves the day with her super duper fox powers. Once more, things explode and stuff. Christina is pinned beneath some rubble. All magic is removed from her and all white people, which is fair, because if we've learnt one thing from J.K. Rowling, it's that white people don't deserve magic. Then the gang high fives, except for Atticus, because he is definitely dead. While all the grown-ups get ready to leave, Dee comes along with a robotic arm and a hellhound for a pet and crushes Christina's head like a grape. It's a beautiful thing. The end.
Deep dive.
It's cool to know other people think about this stuff too.
Firstly, what a welcome return to the podcast, getting Storytime with Damask back. It's been a while.
I feel weak in my body after that. Like, I feel deprived of nutrients.
You spent however long it's been since your last one, which might be over, maybe 2 years now.
Yeah, probably. It's been a long time. It's
been a while just to recover from the last one to do this again. So we'll wait another couple of years to get another one of those.
That's right. It's special edition episodes, these ones.
Totally. Second of all, if that didn't show anything, what a mess of a narrative this show is. Let's start there.
Yeah.
Let's start.
Uh-huh.
What do you think is going wrong with this show when it comes to, do you think there's anything wrong with what the show is doing from a overall serialized narrative point of view? Because I kept looking at this show and thinking, this is like in line with Buffy, what Buffy has done a lot of ways, you know, episode of the week, we'll do a certain genre or monster or idea, but overall, you know, this will build to something bigger over the course of a season. You might even argue sort of Sabrina, the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina's got similar stuff going on, which we've already said is very Buffy-esque.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, it just didn't seem to really come together in a cohesive way. And I think for me, the problem was there was just too many ideas. So the overarching narrative was so convoluted and complicated that there wasn't enough space to fit that in and have these high-concept episodes.
The thing is, it was doing two things at once and two really big things at once. It was like this really convoluted, like, season-long arc.
Mm.
And then you've got these really complicated kind of different genre for every episode, mm-hmm. which is a hard thing to pull off, full stop. So then you combine those two things and it just becomes a bit unwieldy. And I think I was having fun watching it week to week, and at like every episode I'd have a few drinks. I'm like, I don't really know what's going on, but I know I'm having a good time watching whatever I'm watching. So that was fine. But then it wasn't until we got to the final episode, right? So the culmination of all those little kind of exposition dumps that the poor Christina character has to constantly put down.
Walk into wherever they are. She just shows up because she's got a reason to be there, I guess. Have a bit of, you know, an exchange, talk a bunch of lore and leave again. And you're left going, why isn't anyone doing something about this? Yeah. Like,
but you can quickly like forget about those scenes and just be like, okay, I'm on this adventure. I'm in this kind of show, blah, blah, whatever. And that was fine. I think that's a fine way to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until the final episode watching that it made me go, oh, I really don't care about that story.
Yeah.
And I think it made me go, oh, this show really would have excelled as a Monster of the Week Scooby-Doo show.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do, if you do want an overarching narrative, that's fine. But it can't be the most complicated part of the show when the show itself seems to think that it's one of the least interesting parts of it.
Well, in episode to episode. I think it just comes down to execution. And in a lot of ways, I think it comes down to writing. And I don't necessarily mean dialogue, although I don't think the dialogue is exceptional in this show. There are very few quotable lines that I remember from this show, realistically. I think the characters are particularly strong in a lot of ways. I think they have interesting struggles they're going through. I care and sympathize with these characters in a lot of ways. But then what it kind of all boiled down to me in a lot of ways is stuff that we've seen plenty of. You know, it's all about the power of family and the power of friends and, like, you know, the solutions at the end seem to come down to just their connections more than anything, I think, because beyond that, it's hard to say what the magic was doing or not doing. I'm still confused about why some things happened or why they didn't. The power of the individuals and then collectively, I don't know. And it's just like, but there are ways of doing that so much simpler without it feeling like I need to be reading a Wikipedia page along with it to understand what's going on, or having a fantastic story time with Damask to even follow along with that. Like, it's just, it got in its own way so often when trying to get to what I don't think was all that amazing or revelatory a sort of overall arc for the season.
Yeah, I think I love the idea of this adult Goosebumps thing, but you get to go back to the same characters with each adventure. I think that's really cool. But yeah, it was one of those things that I just had to kind of wave it away, all of those things that I couldn't follow. Like I said in my spoiler-free review, you know, there were plenty of times where I didn't understand where the characters got their information from. And I'm sure it was in dialogue, but the dialogue was so either spoken really quickly or really quietly or just like gone in a flash, and there was so much information there, and then we're cut to another scene. I found it hard to absorb things.
Yeah, it was said very matter-of-factly. They would say words and names, and it's been a couple of, you know, a few weeks since I've finished watching the season. I haven't gone back to it, but, like, you know, they throw around the name of an ancestor of somebody or a relative of somebody or a book or a piece of magic or the pages or the whatever it is. And, like, I know they need to get these MacGuffin-y things, but I don't necessarily always understand the significance of them well enough to care why they need to get them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's just a failure of the writing. It's a failure of you making me, the audience, give a shit about that stuff. That's the problem there, I think.
Yeah, I thought, you know, the first time I watched it was week to week, you know, in lockdown, having a good time watching it. Obviously, I was like, I can't follow this, but I can't follow a lot of things, and I've accepted that about myself. And then on the rewatch, I was doing it sober in prep for the podcast because, like, I need to know what's going on. Come on. And even then I was like, oh, I don't think it's me.
No.
I think it is, like, really hard. And obviously, like, reading recaps and stuff is really helpful to do that. But
sure,
that onus shouldn't be on the audience to have to kind of really reflect on not themes, not any of that stuff, but plot.
Yeah.
Like, that's a lot of work to do. And in saying that, I think this show can still be really enjoyed.
Definitely.
If, you know, if you don't care, like I didn't the first time I watched it, because I wasn't really watching it thinking about reviewing it for the show. I was just watching it, and I had a blast. Every episode finished and I was like, that was so much fun, or that was so gross, or like I just didn't know where we were going at any turn. And that can just be a really rewarding feeling in and of itself when watching TV. And I'll be like, where the fuck are they going to take us? Or you're in the middle of the story, like, where could this possibly go in a really exciting way?
There's a show that's currently airing week to week that I'm having the exact experience with every week. I'm freaking loving it of that. The Mandalorian.
Yes,
Which we'll get to talking about.
Oh, so excited to talk about that.
Just see how the rest of the season goes. But that's like that experience of the week to week, come in, sit down for 40 minutes, come out the other side going, I don't know what's going to happen this week.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to then go, I had a fun time this week, can't wait for next week.
Yeah.
It's a great thing to have.
It is.
But yeah, when you start to like sift through, I'm not even talking about the Mandalorian now, I'm going back to Lovecraft Country. When you start to sift through it and like go, okay, but did that hold up?
Yeah.
I think the thing as well is when it's complicated story or when the plot seems complicated, right?
Mm.
And you don't get it. There'll be people out there who are fans that will go, oh, you just weren't paying enough attention. Or you just didn't get it. And the thing is, I don't think the story is that complicated. It's just been told poorly.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't think this is any more complicated than a season of Charmed. Do you know what I mean? Like in terms of the great good versus evil magic, you know, sort of plot that's going on here. That's what it, the themes are more interesting than that, but the plot is not that much more difficult. It's just messy and told poorly. And so then it's frustrating to try and deal with that as it happens at you.
There are, anyway. I mean, yes, it's not overly complicated. I think there are a lot of characters, particularly a lot of like kind of, I think, probably superfluous characters. I'm thinking of, I get there are like a catalyst for a lot of plot points, I guess, but that evil cop who is in like challenging Christina in terms of the right of taking over or whatever.
Do we need Christina to have that problem? Do we need our villain to have her own biases that she's dealing with? Like,
yeah, that's, I don't
the
think
purpose
so.
Of that, right, as far as I understand, and from what I understand from the books, right, because Christina is not a woman, right? She's a man, a white man, who wants this thing from Atticus, right, essentially. And so by making her a woman, not a bad choice.
As a white woman, I'm going to write a letter, like that kind of struggle.
Sure.
Yeah.
But she then is given this whole thing that she is fighting against men who don't deem her worthy of the position that she rightly, by right of blood, which we can argue.
By self-righteousness.
By self-righteousness that she deserves, right? Yeah. And that is her struggle this season. Did we need that for that character? Yeah. Is that worth our time?
But the thing is like, they say that's a struggle for her, but is it really that much of a struggle? I know she wants the thing, but other than like wanting to be, you know, the leader of whatever the fuck that is, she lives a pretty amazing life and I'm not seeing a whole lot of struggle. So it doesn't feel like as a white woman, I am being persecuted. She's an incredibly rich, powerful white woman. So
is it a critique on and, white feminism?
And I think it absolutely is because Christina posits herself as an ally.
Yeah,
and I think in terms of Ruby, who begins suspicious, is then manipulated by this white ally character who offers them like a slice of what they have in terms of being compliant and all of that stuff. But I just don't think it's effective or clear. I think it's murkied by the more kind of more influences and shit that you just put on top of it to make a point. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. The more bullet points you have, you might as well just write a fucking chapter because you're just making it too murky.
Yeah. Well, it's, again, I think it comes down to like, I think on a character by character level, I definitely feel for their plight. I feel for their struggles. Yeah. But sometimes I feel the show is just not giving them enough room to really have that properly or touches on it, gives it that millisecond in the spotlight and then moves on really quickly onto other bullshit. And it's like, again, it's a show that's too full. It's got these great elements. You mix them all together ineffectively and you're just left with a mess.
I just don't understand why she was, and if someone wants to, they can explain it to me. I'm open to it. Why she needed or wanted the experience of being murdered the same way that Emmett Till was.
It's one of my absolutely, I do not understand. Have I missed something?
I don't know what it's in, like I don't know what the metaphor is. I don't know what the symbolism is. I don't get it.
I don't get it either. I have no idea.
Because I thought the conversation with Christina and Ruby have about, obviously, she doesn't really care about Emmett Till. It's not important to her saying that to Ruby, and obviously like showing their difference of perspective and all of that. And like that perhaps like at that time, a chasm that simply cannot be crossed. Which is fine. But then like I felt like I knew her position. I felt like I knew the character. And then this moment happens and I don't know what it is for.
Is the comment being made without ever actually commenting on it? Because we see Christina do it, but then no other character knows that she did it, right? Like Ruby doesn't get to have the conversation with her about her doing that to discuss it. So let's say, for instance, the conversation is you can't ever understand or you don't really care about Emmett Till, right? She goes, well, I'm going to find out what that's like to experience. So she goes and gets herself murdered in the same way that he did to experience it. And then the comment is, but she was never really in danger because she was always going to survive,
like,
right?
You don't have the fear of being like...
Totally. And that might be the comment. That might be what the show is trying to say. It's like you can try and put yourself in these shoes, but you can't ever know that experience, right? It's performative, right?
Yeah.
Now, that could be it.
But it's then not
the
clear.
But then the show doesn't take the time to then have a character like Ruby who would have something to say about that and say, you've missed the point here.
Yeah.
You know, you can go and pretend to be that as much as you like. You can be performative in that regard.
Yeah.
And like, there is meat there.
It's not simply, you know, the fist against bone. It is like the fear not only instilled in the person, but then the community, the message, the sense of like, well, totally. We can do this to anyone, which is not Christina's experience of that. It's like she gets punched in the face and drowned, but she never lives with fear.
Yeah, exactly right.
Which is fucking
and
bullshit.
The consequences of the actual, the like, obviously, the horrific way that he was tortured is awful as well.
Mm.
But, like, he's also dead, you know? And the overall effect of that.
Yes.
On not just him, but on the community and everything, right? Mm-hmm. None of that is ever at risk for her. So, yes, there is meat on those bones. But the show forgets to chew on the meat.
Yeah.
It forgets to actually do the part of going, now let's see what her doing that means to other characters. So thematically, it's got powerful ideas, but it doesn't take the time to do the work to then apply those ideas back onto the characters that we care about. In this case, Ruby is the perfect person. She's perfectly positioned to have the next step of that conversation with her because they've set it up. You know, you don't care about Emmett Till. You don't know what that's like. You don't know our experience.
Mm-hmm.
She goes and tries to have that experience. She comes back and said, I did it. It was awful. And she goes, that's not there should be a conversation how that's not the same thing. And it doesn't happen. That's the problem.
I think, like, I guess the show just doesn't give itself enough time.
I think that's it. I think it's trying to do too much in too little amount of time.
Yeah.
And I think that's true on every level.
Do you think episode there's, like, perhaps episode, a bit seasonal? Of fear in this show about, you know, this
not
might
a second
be, yeah, this might be a one season
I think that
thing.
Happens a lot.
Yeah.
I think that happens a lot in TV. I think I'm noticing that more and more.
Mm.
When Netflix, and this is not a Netflix show, this is an HBO show, but when shows seemingly relatively popular and well-reviewed and critically acclaimed shows like Glow just disappear off the air all of a sudden, you know, they're offered a final season and they're like, no, we're not going to do that anymore. It's like there is a fear that we've got to make our shot while we can.
Mm.
But the ultimate consequence is that they're trying to do too much.
Yeah, it's the whole kill your darlings thing. Like, well, yes, this might be the only time you get to tell that story. At least you got to,
And the thing is, it's really funny about this show. It's a 10-episode season, and I'm really glad that seasons have been reduced
this
23 episodes to 20. To
just
down
for
to
us,
sort
really.
Of,
I love that.
Down to 20, 10. But they are also hour-long episodes. Like, these are not short still.
Mm.
And so if there was more, maybe that scene between Christina and Ruby existed and was on the cutting room floor and they just can't fit in because it's
then
too much
cut
here.
The Christina scene. Why would you leave in the setup and remove the payoff?
I imagine it was an expensive scene. I imagine, you know.
I think people want to see this white woman murdered, which is fair. Accurate. Yeah.
But let's talk about that for a second even. Since we've honed in on this specific plot point. Let's just take a step back from Christina. This happened. This awful thing happened to a character, but none of that happened on screen. Did I missed
Wait,
the part?
What?
Did that happen? Did we see Emmett's death? Am I forgetting?
No, they would never show that.
No. Did we even get the inkling that he was going to be killed? Did we see a scene where he was confronted by people or anything?
No. So it happened in Mississippi.
Yes.
Yeah. So the hints were dropped that obviously Bobo was Emmett Till. So obviously you know what's going to happen to him.
Sure.
Yeah.
So it was just, we didn't. Okay.
I believe there was a moment in the Ouija board scene that alludes to something happening to him, but I can't remember what it was.
I find that really frustrating that the show, I don't need to see him die.
Mm.
It seems though that a little bit more time on screen to set up any sort of idea that something, that this is going to happen, rather than just cut to the start of an episode and this character is dead and we're talking about what happened in past tense, very frustrating. And this happens multiple times this season where things are talked about having happened and we don't get to experience any of the moment as it's happening. Again, I don't need to see the murder.
Yeah.
I do need to experience with a lot. If I want him to care about that character, I need to spend some time with that character
I
in
think
that situation.
In the context of this show, it's more than a character, it's a moment, right? So if you're a black audience in America, you know that moment. You know why it's important.
Oh,
and so
agreed.
I don't think they're interested in informing us white people as to like the importance of that, or that it's character based as though he's a character in the show necessarily. I think it's more, it's sparking a theme, a conversation within the show about black experience.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes, totally get that.
Yeah.
But I think the problem of talking about something, telling, not showing, is a problem this show has a lot though as well. So this is one, that's one example, right? Other examples. There are things that happen in the finale that we don't understand why or how they happened unless you're paying extremely close attention to a bunch of crazy visions that GR is...
It's A-H, so that's...
GR, thank you.
That's how I pronounce it. Could be wrong.
Is having, while she's connected to that Atticus big epic Avengers-style moment that's happening at the very end, right? Where we see things like Atticus introducing the hellhound beast thing to D, right? There's a flash of that.
No idea. Yeah.
Yeah. This
I watched the finale once, so no idea. Yeah, go on, describe it to me.
I have to imagine there's some explanation for why Letitia still has a protection spell on her at the very end, which looks different. Like, these are things that just happen and then are explained through flashes during two other characters having an interaction during a bunch of magical shit. And it's like, why the fuck did this choice get made? I understand the decision to keep some information from us because you want us to have some form of surprise.
Moment, yeah.
But instead, all you're doing is just not telling me the information that I need effectively in any way whatsoever. That's not foreshadowing. That's not anything. It's retconning and going, here's the stuff we didn't tell you. So now you know why they're going to win this instead of lose this scenario. This is how we had to fake Jeopardy for you, basically.
Yeah.
That's bullshit. There are characters who are introduced and seem to get a weird amount of screen time or emphasis and then just disappear. The character of Tree.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about Tree, yeah.
Who comes with them to, is it Boston or where they go to?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, he's in the bar at the start when Atticus talks to him when he's looking for his dad. And then he's talking to him later and they have that awkward car trip and then a conversation at the museum and then he's gone. And it's like, why did this character get so much screen time and lines? I don't even remember this character's name.
I don't have any answers for you, so just keep going.
The woman, when they went in that same episode, they went into like the Indiana Jones style like temple run underneath the museum.
Yep.
And then they find that like Native American woman who they need some...
Two-spirit person. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes. Who then is killed and they're like, oh, she's gone. Okay. What? What was that about? Why? Why introduce this character? What a waste of an idea. Why even have this person in the show whatsoever? I don't understand. Even Gia, I find, is particularly one of my, probably my favorite character in the entire show in terms of the amount.
Who's Gia?
Gia, the.
Who is Gia?
Gia, as in the Korean woman.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking of GIA. I was like, who's Gia?
Her episode, I thought, was one of the best episodes of the season.
I loved it. Right? Bloody
because
loved it.
It was a complete thought. Yeah. Right? It was a complete start to finish story.
Stunning.
And very effectively wasn't it done. Stunning? And completely pulled into it. It was like watching.
I was in love the whole time.
It was like watching with everything that was the happening. Notebook, some weird, like, twisted Twilight version.
The Notebook.
It has that, like, or
romanticism kind of
around
to it.
War in particular as well, yeah, and okay. There's like a star-crossed lovers aspect to this.
The Notebook does have war in it, doesn't it? It's been a long time.
I was
going
to say Pearl Harbor as well. Pearl Harbor, which is a terrible movie.
Pearl's favorite film. Yep.
But it was trying to do like, or Titanic or something like that. Like, it's got that like epic star-crossed lovers tragic ending. These two can never be
together.
You've
got to find better examples anyway.
Twilight was the one that I came to. Like, it's literally about werewolves and vampires. Like, it's got a
classic
similar
war.
Thing to it.
Yep.
Anyway. Point was, I thought it was like a particularly effective sort of monster love story they had going on there.
Yeah.
And I came to the end of that and I was like, this character I find particularly compelling in terms of her story, where she's come from, what's happened to her, where she's at. And then they've been doing this thing, the phone calls and stuff with Atticus, and you're like, there's a mystery here. Then she shows up to get pissed off that he's got a new girlfriend and then come back at the end and do her magic thing to solve the problem. That's it. I'm like, that's not a character anymore.
Well, also,
it's such a waste of an idea and a character, and a really, really good character, I thought.
First of all, I don't think that she came to America and was pissed off he had a girlfriend.
That is what happens in that scene.
Absolutely not.
Oh, sorry. Other way around. Sorry, Letitia is pissed off that he had a girlfriend once more time.
Thank you.
Other way around.
She was
take it back.
Fine. She was, and
Gia
Atticus
was good. Yeah.
Was fucking rude.
Yeah.
May I say?
No, you're right. You're
they
right.
They were mean to her.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. But you know,
she was fine.
But that's ultimately what she gets used. She comes back into the plot to show up for one scene so Letitia can get pissed off. Then she disappears until Atticus needs her again and finds her in a bar.
Absolutely, like Deus ex girlfriend. Yeah.
Deus ex girlfriend. That's exactly what it is. Deus ex girlfriend. And it, for something that's for such a strong episode that does so much work to make me this compelling character that I'm invested in, and then to Deus ex girlfriend her at the end, I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you, show? I do not understand how it can get so many things, execution really right, and then completely stuff it up when it matters the
most. It's just too much is the answer to all of that. It's just... too
Rant
much.
Over.
Just I think I'm exhausted. Are we all exhausted at home? Yes. No, I don't have answers for you. I think it simply comes down to the fact that if you want what you wanted, which was consistent storytelling and commitment to plot in a clear way for audiences to interpret, you're not going to get it. You're just not going to get it in this show unless you rewatch it a bunch of times, read a bunch of shit, or your attention to detail is insane. And I think yours is pretty good.
I don't think your attention to detail is going to help you. It's like, because again, it just throws ideas. One more idea that I just remembered. When Atticus, another thing that happened off screen, right? That's really annoying. In Hippolyta's excellent episode.
Love it.
Right? Yeah. We cut back after the end of her odyssey that she's been on to Atticus coming out of the portal. And he's like, where are you, Hippolyta? And then we see he's got the book, Lovecraft Country, right? And then he goes back in the next episode, the episode after, he's talking with Montrose and he's like, Montrose, I think that's what his character's name. And he's like, I got this book, right? I went to the future. I saw all these white people rioting and this figure out of nowhere with a robot arm gave me this book. And it's written by my future son and it tells this is the story and what's going to happen to us. And I'm like, you know what would have been great? To see the scene you just described. Why did we not see this scene?
It would have been great.
Why are you talking to us about one of the coolest ideas possible? But then the book really doesn't serve any purpose. It doesn't serve any real purpose except to make him convinced that he's doomed. But like, that is such a powerful idea. You've taken something that is true from our reality and made it like cross over with the book's reality and your fictionalized world, like alternate world things. For why? What? Why? Why introduce this concept if you're not going to do anything with it?
There is too much telling and not enough showing. Absolutely. And I can't absorb that much dialogue. It's just not going to happen for me. But how fun was Hippolyta's episode,
though?
That
was an extremely fun episode.
Like that Afro-futuristic, like, alien lady with a huge afro comes in. And I was like, fuck yes. Didn't you have some fun?
No. I actually had a really, really good time with a bunch of episodes. Maybe we should talk about like some of the stuff we really liked. And I'll let you take over for a while because I've been ranting a lot.
Well, that one, a fav show, like when beautiful Hippolyta. Well, okay. So what I love is Hippolyta is a goddamn genius. Mm-hmm. Like that, the kind of the figuring out the problem solving of just like, oh, maths and science and shit. I'm not smart enough to speak about it more intelligently than that. But I thought that was cool. Then her travels, to which I went, what the fuck's going on? And then, oh, I mean, a multiverse time travel story. I mean, that's, and I don't have to like follow where we are in time. That's my kind of jam.
Just
like,
being one place or another.
Yeah.
This is the appeal of Doctor Who, right? It's yeah. Like, yeah, yeah, we're somewhere cool right now. Yeah. Don't think about too hard about why we're here.
Except for when, what's your favourite head Doctor Who writer's
Stephen
name?
Moffat.
He got way too far up his own ass and I couldn't follow a fucking thing towards the end there. It was...
The River Song of it all, complicated
just,
things.
Oh, ouch, my brain. If I can just enjoy the experience of like a Bill and Ted, if you will.
Sure.
Just kind of, bloop, here we are. Oh, sure. Isn't this fun? That's great. Yep. So that's what I got in that episode, which was so much fun. Mm-hmm. I love like the visuals of that episode, particularly the one where they're kind of in that very kind of pulpy H.P. Lovecraft planet as like explorers or whatever.
Yeah.
In like a spaceship version really of their like, car. And it was...
And the awesome like bubble like head suit yeah. thing they had going on. Yeah, it was cool.
Mwah, gorgeous. Absolutely love that episode. I've seen some critiques of it and I think it's more to do with the plot as to how they got there, which is valid. But the National Treasure episode, mm-hmm. I had a lot of fun with because so often Angela and I at home will be like, oh, I just want like a new adventure movie.
Yeah.
Like where are those awesome adventure films?
Uncharted's coming out next year. That could fulfill that.
As if that doesn't look fun to me. They're going to take it really seriously.
No. Uncharted's a fun series. Nathan Drake is a quipster. It's going to be Indiana Jones style, that one. If that's what you're looking for.
I hope so.
I think that'll be.
Okay. Fingers crossed. Because the last really good one, oh, I quite enjoyed, obviously, the first new Jumanji with The Rock.
Yeah,
that
right.
was fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And then before that, it was Brendan Fraser's Journey to the Center of the Earth. That's really good. Because that was post-Mummy.
Well, yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The Mummy, like The Mummy for me, I like, you think Indiana Jones, National Treasure, I've not really watched. The Mummy, oh man, yep. The Mummy is still an all-timer. Yep,
absolutely.
Sorry.
So I love that. I love that shit. And so to watch that on my TV, I was like, this is fun. Mm-hmm. Even if I didn't understand the clues, nor did the show particularly explain it well to me. What else? There's so many episodes.
I kept waiting for them,
remember.
Their rash decision to walk down one of those tunnels to come back and bite them in the ass because it felt ill-considered. You know,
they just went with one, didn't they?
They just kind of went with one and it was the right one.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking like they're making decisions. Atticus is saying, wait, we should think about this more. And I was like, oh, okay. So they're going to go down this one. It's going to not be the right one. It's going to be a problem for them.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't. Was like,
well, I thought...
Well, why not just have them figure it out properly?
Because the show kind of signifies this, but I felt like it came after the decision. So obviously, like, we're going down this way and then Atticus starts walking down behind them and picks up the torch, the lantern that's been left.
Yes.
It's like, wouldn't you point at them and be like, oh, well, clearly that's a sign that someone's gone down here.
Sure.
But that wasn't part of the decision process as far as I can tell.
No.
Yeah. Okay, cool. All right.
They were going in what order they think he did things. It's like, this is the last, we think he was down here last. Anyway, I don't know. Nothing got explained in this show properly. It just happened. Like, the magic of it. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah. Meet me in Daegu. I'm probably saying that wrong.
Sorry. So good.
So, I loved it. I'll happily watch it a million times over. Also, do we think that Gia's friend, there was yes. like vibes there, right? Like, oh, I really like your socks and like, let's hang out and let's stroll together and let me look deeply in your eyes as I talk about us being different.
Maybe. There wasn't enough to
I'm
say.
I'm going
to
say there absolutely was and I dug it.
I'm going to say you're the expert on this, so let's go with that. Sure.
And trying to find any subtext I possibly can. Absolutely.
How does that episode in terms of the character of Atticus? How does that gel for you in terms of
good question.
This guy, he shows up, he seems just this cool, like super buff and ripped and particularly handsome looking, like nerd guy, right?
I have never seen a more perfect body in my entire life.
Add the glasses, really going for something there. It's going to awaken some things.
As a gay woman, I was very horny throughout this show and mostly because of Atticus. It was very confusing anyway. But sometimes you just got to appreciate perfection. It's like, that is yummy. Anyway, what were we saying?
But like he shows up at the start of this show and like, you know, he's come back from the war. He's obviously a little bit scarred with that. He's got a troubled relationship with his dad in particular. He's trying to find his dad. Finds all these family secrets, blah, blah, blah. On you go. Then you flash back to Korea and you go, oh, this guy did some unspeakable things.
Yes.
Like murdered civilians in cold blood. And
which, as we're finding out in Australia, not that uncommon.
Not that uncommon, apparently.
Yeah. Bunch of war criminals over here.
Yeah.
Oh, I saw it.
Sorry, that's really sobering. Yeah.
That's right. I saw a hashtag earlier this morning, like solidarity with Australia, like against China. And I just like, I can't get behind our Prime Minister being more insulted by a fake image than the war crimes that our own soldiers committed. Anyway, fuck that. That's all I have to say about that subject.
100% agree. Yes. Anyway, that piece of information, seeing him in that light and then somehow managing to try and still humanize him and make him a relatable or forgivable sort of person because we watched him kill two people in cold blood, is a very, very interesting thing for the show to try and pull off, I think. Mm. And I think is relatively successful somehow.
I mean, it works well in parallel with the character that they really get us to connect with in Gia, right?
Yeah.
So, like, it is about ultimately that conversation that they do have about
They've done monstrous things, but they are not monsters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I thought it was smart to kind of... Whether that plays into Atticus outside of this story... I'm not sure.
Well, that's the other problem. Oh, how well does it connect back to the rest of the
story? But within that episode itself, I thought it's really beautiful. Kind of, they've both done terrible, terrible things. Mm-hmm. Is that indicative or reflective of the actual experience of Korean women during the Korean War? No. Mm. But in terms of this story specifically, I thought it was very well done and very compelling.
I just thought everything about this episode was so executed. Mm. Any other standout bits? I personally really liked... So, first episode I thought was great, and I've had this conversation with Paul Mitzi, friend of the show as well, and he stopped after episode 2 because I thought episode 2 was a ridiculously massive drop in quality. That's where they go to the House of White People.
Oh, yes.
And it was like, from an excellent road trip through racist America. I didn't know about sundown
counties. There
was
so much going on in that episode.
In episode two.
Yeah.
I didn't know about sundown counties or whatever it's called.
Me either. That car chase
sundown
was
city, stuff like that. That was terrifying.
Amazing.
Yeah. 100%.
Far out edge of your seat stuff.
That interaction with the cop when he finds them, when they're like getting ready to leave or whatever, and then when they cross the bridge or the railway tracks and they're there and
tension.
All of that. And that was so well done.
Yes, agreed.
And then episode two, they get to this mystery like mansion of white people, as I said, and it's like it's doing some things but none of it's sticking anymore and it's all very messy and convoluted. I don't care about what's happening, and it was such a and like having them not remember the events of the episode before a couple of the characters was like, why are we doing this? This is complicating things. It was just a massive drop in quality. And then we got back to Chicago and like things are happening very quickly, and Letitia buys this house and one of the most effective ghost horror stories I've seen in ages. The stuff at the end of the episode when they're in the basement and like all the people showing up and just how effective they were at showing how like weathered and distraught she was, like trying to cast this spell.
Can I just say though,
one of the best exorcism things I've seen in ages.
One of my least favorite things in horrors is people having different body parts stitched to different areas.
Did you enjoy the baby head?
The tiny baby head? No, I didn't, bro. And you know why? Because I think I might have been 13 or 14. I watched The Last King of Scotland. I will never fucking watch that movie again. It is so horrific. It is one of the most traumatizing things I've ever seen, in which he suspects his wife of cheating on him. This dictator in fucking I can't remember where it was. I blocked the whole thing out.
Scotland.
It's definitely not Scotland. And I just, all I remember is his poor wife, I think it was played by Kerry Washington. Anyway, wakes up with her legs stitched where her arms are and her arms where her legs were. Then she obviously like almost immediately dies as soon as she sees it. It's fucking horrific and I hate it and it's very upsetting. Oh. And ever since then, it's been awful. They did the same thing in American Horror Story and I fucking hate it and I refuse to watch any more of that shit show. Mm. And this was less horrific because like a bit of like self-empowerment story attached to that, which is nice, but still not something I like to see.
No.
And I just want to put that out there.
That there's a bit in that episode as well where they've been setting up all episode where the elevator is going to decapitate someone, right? And they finally get it on like the white bully guys who have been terrorizing the house coming into the house and they get taken out by the elevator. And like super graphic. Like the camera holds on a close-up of this wound where the head used to be.
Yeah,
but it's like you can see like the muscles and stuff. I was like, that is proper disgusting.
Was it a nice insight as a chiropractor though, just to kind of see that?
I've seen cadavers before. I know what they look like. It's like nothing there. Let's see. You got to learn anatomy. I was like, oh yeah, right. These are the jugular vein. There's like that's like probably C7 or T1, right? That makes sense.
So when you saw that, then you're like, been there, done that. Just like back at uni, righto.
Exactly. Exactly. A little less grey and withered. A bit more fresh than the cadavers you get to work on. Boy, this is telling you an interesting episode. And yeah, I just thought that was a really effective episode. I also, in terms of like the graphic horror, every time we watched Ruby transform was amazing. I couldn't get over how great that was.
I quite like that, to be fair.
No, it is like fantastic. It is so well done every single time. But I stand by the point that the graphic violence stopped being effective the more the characters stopped being affected by it.
Yes,
so one of the reasons
episode
3 was so good is because when the horrific stuff with this severed limbs reattached mixed up body thing was happening with the ghost, Letitia is having this moment trying to exorcise this evil spirit or whatever. You can see the strain on her as she deals with this horror, right? Like she's being affected by this moment. And then the more that Ruby transformed, the less and less she was affected by it. It became sexy and sexual at one point.
Do you think that's part of it though? Like the more violence is perpetrated against you, the more you kind of absorb it without much reaction.
Sure.
And then turn you become more violent.
You could make that argument. I don't think the show
didn't tell you that.
Doesn't do anything with that idea if that's true. It just was a thing where they kept trying to do blood and gore and the characters just more and more shrugged it off. And so it just became more cartoony as it went along. Like there was a spectacular sequence, I think it's the end of episode 8 or 9, where all the cops show up around the house and they're going to attack them. And then those hound dogs show up because they're protecting Atticus because of the spell. And super effective action scene, really gory and violent. It's a one-shot camera, like moving throughout the action. And like, I just don't think they could care less. They move on so quickly from this stuff. They're not affected by how horrific this thing is. That it then becomes cartoony and boring by nature of the characters not reacting to it anymore. If they're not in jeopardy, if they don't feel like they're in jeopardy, then why should I feel for them in that moment, I guess? And that's what the show started to become as it went along. So that was disappointing. But boy, those moments were so effective. The minstrels were fucking creepy.
Topsy and Bopsy, yeah.
Topsy and Bopsy.
Very, very, very scary.
How do you feel about returning to Tulsa? This is the second time we've been to the Tulsa Massacre with television shows.
So good in Watchmen.
Yes.
So good in Watchmen. Oh, my God. I need to rewatch that episode, actually. Fucking hell.
It's getting its
so
moment, that piece of history. Something that a lot of people, particularly we as Australians, never knew about, but apparently Americans.
Apparently, yeah. Americans really had no idea about it, which is shocking to me.
And so it's getting its moment.
But who knows how many goddamn Aboriginal massacres we just have no idea about.
That's a good point. Are there any particular characters you want to talk about? Letitia, Ruby, Atticus, Montrose, anyone, Hippolyta, anyone that really stood out in terms of their stories?
Ruby certainly stood out to me. I thought the relationship with her and Letty was really interesting.
Agreed.
Particularly considering they have very different experiences, particularly as women of color, all that stuff. So I love that kind of antagonistic, competitive relationship they had. Mm-hmm. And then we see that reflected in Ruby's desire to work at that department store. Mm-hmm. And then obviously she doesn't get it, and therefore, because she lives by this idea, this falsehood that if you work hard enough, if you pick yourself up by your bootstraps,
yep,
you will then be given the opportunities that you feel you deserve. And, you know, all those other, you know, black people that haven't done the things that you see for yourself, it's because they didn't work hard enough.
Yep.
And then obviously she discovers what a falsehood that is when, you know, that other lady gets the job and she doesn't have, you know, Ruby's resume. And it's just circumstantial that, you know, the department store manager is a fucking creepo rapist. Mm. So I kind of, seeing her in those moments was really interesting, seeing her kind of poking at that woman who works at the department store, having anger at lost opportunity and blame clearly on the wrong person, mm-hmm. all that stuff I really liked. Did I love the violent sodomizing of the manager? Not so much. Mm. I don't love revenge rape.
Yes.
Generally speaking, it's a lot, particularly since it isn't really seen to have any effect on Ruby that she has perpetuated something so violent.
That's again, violence is just sort of like water off a duck's back on these people over yeah. time. Yeah.
And I love the anger in that scene. Mm-hmm. I love that feeling of revenge and righteousness. I love all of that. It's simply, it's a very violent rape is mm-hmm. what happens, or sexual assault, I should say. Yeah, which is full on. But generally, I love Ruby. I loved her a lot.
What you were talking about when you sort of started that bit there about Ruby and Letitia and sort of their sisterly dynamic was really interesting. I just wanted to really put out there, Journey Smollett and Wunmi Mosaku, I think there are a couple of scenes where they're talking and I'm just like, you are giving this dialogue way more than is on the page. Like, they were just knocking out of the park and making me really care and, like, just feeling that the complicated nature of their relationship. But obviously, they care about each other, but there is a lot has happened in the past, multiple instances where at least one of them has let the other down, if not both ways.
Mm.
And you felt all of that. But the performances throughout the entire cast, but particularly I thought from Wunmi Mosaku, was brilliant. Just yes. like all the way through,
start
to finish,
yep.
brought it in every scene. And it really, really helped. When things were losing me plot-wise, the actors were keeping me in. And I was going to say the same thing about Michael K. Williams, who we know obviously from The Wire.
Mm-hmm. Montrose.
Playing yep. Montrose. And Montrose is an interesting character as well because he's got... Again, he was one of those characters that seemed to have a lot of stuff going on. They bring it up for a second and then move away from it.
Yeah.
And then, like, in the moment when they give it its due, I was caring and I was affected by it to some degree.
I mean, he's just an incredible actor.
Like, he is.
He sells everything, yeah.
And then other times I felt like they're not... While the performers are bringing it every time and that works, the show overall keeps, like... It keeps forgetting to do it long term. It keeps forgetting to sew it into the fabric of the show overall, and that was frustrating.
Yeah.
So you'd have like the revelation that he is a gay man and that what that lifestyle for him is like now and what keeping that hidden, his entire life, his friendship with Atticus' mum, whether he's actually Atticus' dad or not, what happened back in Tulsa, etc. All those moments
mm-hmm.
are meaningful. Yep. Yes. And emotionally, I felt them particularly when the performance was there, but didn't always feel like it did anything beyond that. It didn't seem to fold back into the overall plot enough.
Mm.
Like, it was like the genre shifts per episode. It's like, we'll bring it up. That's something worth talking about. It's now gone.
Yeah.
It's not no longer relevant to the rest of the story or the season as a whole. And that was frustrating to me.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think the complications around like black gayness. It's like much more complicated within that community, particularly when you're talking about masculinity and masculine ideals and toxic masculinity and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's somewhat displayed in Montrose's, well, how he has been as a father,
mm-hmm.
in seeing that being gay as weakness, overcompensating for that fact by thinking that he has to be incredibly tough on his son, as well as like his...
Sins of the father there as well. Learned that one from his dad.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Absolutely. And also thinking, taking the violence that has been put upon him, and then that's reflected in when he kills the two-spirit person,
mm-hmm.
Obviously being violent with his own son, all that stuff. I don't know what it equates to, though, is the thing. I think like it adds a complicated... It equates
to a tragic, interesting character, but it doesn't know what to do beyond that with it.
Yes. Yeah. I would like to get to know... Well, okay, this kind of comes back to your... I think you said in your spoiler-free review is that it's very serious.
Yes.
And there's no joy. And so it's really hard to really get to know people if they are just trauma or if they are just a person who experiences certain things in the plot. And I think Montrose is a character, and I feel like I do have a sense of him, and I think that's through the performance and in a couple of really great scenes. But he doesn't seem like a real person, I guess, other than like a conduit for trauma, which is, I think, a shame.
Well,
but the show doesn't have room for joy, I guess.
There is an opportunity. That's what's can be frustrating too, is I feel like there's opportunities for that stuff that they just always seem to leave on the table. We have the scene where we find him. He goes and meets that other man, and mm-hmm. they spend, you know, then there's a complicated sexual relationship happening there, obviously.
Oh, that sex scene is very upsetting.
Sure.
Yes.
And that happens. And then he ends up going to what is almost like
the
ball.
The drag show.
Yeah. It goes to the drag show and then seems to be feeling a part of that world for the first time. He's able to embrace his sexuality and identity for the first time in a while. Then he brings this man back to his house and then kicks him out, and that's it.
Yeah.
We never see that person again. There is never a fallout from that interaction or how that ended.
Mm.
And it's like a missed opportunity again to have a conversation about any sort of growth or understanding, or talk to this man about the experience of being with Montrose and what he sees in Montrose. And like all these, we just don't get that stuff.
Yeah. We see the two worlds. I mean, Montrose is just like a stilted, stunted person, obviously. From his experiences, that makes a whole world of sense. But yeah, getting a sense of how he does fit in that world, because clearly they all know, you know, the drag queens and stuff, they all know Montrose. Like,
yeah,
they've clearly spent time with him beyond him just kind of being lifted up in the drag ball. I'd love to see. I mean, it's too much. We already said it's too much.
Yeah.
So how can we ask for them to put in more? I don't know.
I'm really glad you brought up the whole thing about the lack of joy in this show, because I really feel like...
Well, you brought it up originally. Well, sorry, that you reiterated,
because I forgot I even said that, but it really, really does stand out to me that, like, I understand it's meant to be horror a lot of the times, but there's also a lot of just, like, pulpy ideas in here. There are silly ideas in amongst it, and that's part of that pulpy nature, right? It's meant to be over the top and a little bit clunky or a little bit... Yeah, pulpy is the word for it. And then it doesn't seem to embrace that in its characters or its writing in any way along the line. It's always, always, always deathly serious, except when our characters don't seem affected by horrific violence and these sorts of things. It's like, just tonally, it's forgetting to do some things there that are important to make us care or to keep us invested.
Mm-hmm.
It's a frustrating show because of that, because you can see all of the good stuff,
we
just can't make it work together.
Mm. Give me that, yeah. Humanity doesn't always mean heartbreak, you know? Yeah.
Any last words?
Final thoughts.
That's why you always leave a note.
I do have a few side notes.
Mm-hmm.
I did think the show was getting a little bit predictable at times as well, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but like very early on, I was like, oh, George is going to die. I thought he was going to die in episode one.
Mm.
And then when he had that phone call back to Hippolyta, I was like, we're going on a road trip together. I'm like, you're a dead man. Yeah. You're a dead man. Also, how early did you figure out that the man in Tulsa that saved George and his friends and siblings was someone, either Letitia or Atticus? I thought it might be Letitia because at one point she was swinging a bat.
There's a lot of bat swinging.
There's a lot of bat swinging in this. I was like, it has to be one of them.
Classic me, no idea.
Okay.
Yep.
Did I miss something? What's with the Letty protection spell thing that brings her back at the end? Do we understand what happened there? From what I understood, Christina took it off her. That was her punishment for not agreeing to the deal or whatever. I can't remember what the reason was. She took it off Letitia, though.
Mm-hmm.
And then she gets thrown out the window. We think she's dead. And then there's a different, way more detailed mark on her that apparently she lives.
No idea.
No idea? Can someone please explain to me what happened there? Because I'd like to know. Why, as much as you enjoyed this scene, why did we have Dee kill Christina with the robot arm at the end?
Because it's fucking cool, and then obviously tells us that she was the one that gave him the book.
We knew that.
Yeah.
Right? I understand that must have been her in the future that gave Atticus the book. Again, a scene we didn't see, so frustrating that it was just referencing a conversation that was had rather than a scene we saw. Do you think they're setting her up to be the new villain?
I wanted to be the hero, though. I want to be a superhero with a cool arm.
It didn't seem super heroic, what was happening there.
Did to me.
Okay.
At least aspirational. And if that isn't heroic, I don't know what is.
Why did they have to go back to Tulsa on the day of the riots? Or the massacre, I should say.
What is it? The whole grandfather thing with time travel is like, that thing happened which meant that Montrose lived and shit, which means Atticus could be born to then go back and save
grandfather
him, right?
Paradox.
Yeah.
Bootstrap paradox.
Yeah, that one.
Yes. Sure. But that's the only way I could explain it.
That's
a plot contrivance. That's not it is deathly important for the sake that our characters made a decision to go back on that day. That was the effect of them going back on that day.
Mm-hmm.
There was no reason that was the day of all days they had to go back in time.
Because Hippolyta said it's a good idea and she knows everything. Shut up, bro.
What did you think? Do you remember that the life could be a dream comes up a couple of times in the show? In the very, very start of the show. And I think it's just after Atticus has had his weird like Lovecraftian / War of the Worldsian nightmare dream sequence at the very beginning of the movie, at the beginning of the show. And then in the Woody, as they're driving towards...
Sorry, just interrupt. Your cat isn't going toilet in the puzzle pieces, right?
He's just going to sleep.
Okay.
He just loves being...
He loves sitting on puzzle pieces. Boxes. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I know if he looks that way, but no, he just likes to sleep in there.
It's very cute. Okay.
They're driving in Woody and everybody, including GR and stuff, are in there singing Life Could Be a Dream. And it's like, hey, we're a family.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that was effective? Do you think they earned that moment?
I mean, they must have, because I was like, I really like all these characters and this is like a nice reprieve from all the horrific things that have happened.
Sure. I feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Why wasn't there more of this in the show? I was like, that's the sort of thing we need a little bit more of. Mm. You want to sell this idea
of
like just a little bit of fun, a little bit of heartwarm, a little bit of remind me that these people are a family and that they need to, you know, they're stronger together, that they've come a long way together. And they just have that moment, which is relatively effective, but it's way too late.
Fair enough.
A couple of things that made my eyes roll as well. When Atticus is on that machine, right? He's just holding on to like things. He's not actually, his arms aren't tied down.
Maybe it's by magic though.
He could be letting go. Is there any indication that that's the case? Why not just have his arms tied up with ropes so they can see that?
Oh, bro, shut up with that nitpicking bullshit.
Also, as much as we talked about this being Jordan Peele executive show, I did notice finally in the final credits that J.J. Abrams is an executive producer for, and it's got his stink all over this thing. Least favorite and favorite episode. What was your least favorite episode?
Least favorite for me is the last episode, because I think it was at that point that really solidified for me that I did want it just to be, a big bad every kind of episode, Scooby-Doo, Goosebumps, that type of thing. I didn't need this big overarching narrative. Yeah.
Agreed. Least favorite episode was episode 10, Full Circle. It was a mess. It was trying to pull together all the stuff the show had not done the work to get there with. All the worst habits of the show took over. It was a particularly bad episode. It was like a bad season finale of a Charmed or a Buffy or something like that. It really was. Favorite episode?
episode 6, Meet Me in Daiku.
Me too.
You know, it is entirely detached from the series, but like I said, the character of Gia is so compelling.
Yep.
Her struggle is so horrific and her tragedy so unavoidable, which always feels really good and juicy. It was amazing to watch. I was invested very quickly.
Yep.
And I thought the performances in that episode were incredible. I was fascinated by the myth and I was excited throughout just watching it. And I thought it was beautiful. Like, I wanted to watch that movie. Yeah.
So just to really get down to base level here for a second, because I agree, that was my favorite episode as well. I think execution from start to finish as a complete and solid idea was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't weigh itself down too much with all the other ongoing story stuff. And so it was able to just shine in that regard. Mm-hmm. To really bring back to basics, do you ship Atticus and Gia? Is that a yes? You're nodding very, very slightly that you went silent.
I thought there was another question.
The next question was, do you ship Atticus and Letty?
I mean, I'm all for like polyamory, so if they want to get like a situation happening, that's fine.
That's your solution.
I ship him with both of them. I have no problems with him being with either of them. But I mean, he got Letty pregnant, so she should probably follow through with that relationship. Yeah. But I mean, he's dead now, so RIP.
Modern day families are complicated things. They don't need to be in one particular
way. I mean, that's true, but can I just say something?
No.
How fucking patriarchy? Letty has sex for the first time.
Yes.
And gets pregnant? That's so unfair.
That I thought was a really interesting character moment, though, to find that out. Because as far as a character like Letty, right, in terms of she's very confident and, like, seems to be in touch with her body and her sexuality and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And very, you know, as I appreciate that.
I was enjoying myself. Letty is gorgeous.
Gorgeous. Yeah. We can all agree on that. This would be an easy choice on Hot or Not if this was on the Slash Filmcast. Not the Slash Filmcast, the Swapcast podcast. Yeah. The finding out that was her first time having sex was a really interesting thing because it was complete. I would not have expected it. All the signs and nothing explicit, but it made me feel like that she was a sexually active human being or woman, and then both. And
they can be both.
They can be both.
Oh my God.
And I thought that was a really interesting turn for the character to find that out. I don't think they need to do more with it. It was just interesting to know, that's a more interesting, complicated layer to you and understanding who you are and like, I don't know. I really, really liked that. And kind of
this image that people have put on her that wasn't accurate.
Totally.
And it didn't matter if it was or wasn't, but it just simply wasn't and no one had taken the time to actually get to know her on that level.
Sure. Yeah. She also said some things that made it pretty sound like she explicitly slept with other people.
What did she say?
Well, there was the stories getting around, and then she was saying, like, she was doing it in jest that apparently we'd slept together previously with Tree, I think it was, or someone like that.
Oh, yeah, because Tree had told Atticus.
Yeah.
And then she was like, because he was talking about his big dick, she's like, well, I would know that if we had slept together.
That's right, yeah. And, like, little things like
that. Which is clearly saying that they hadn't slept together.
True, but also, I don't know. The idea is that
does she have to go, we didn't sleep together because I'm a virgin?
No, that's it though. But that is like your brain is like still you got the impression that she was probably active enough that someone could tell that story and people would believe it, right? That he could say that. I just think that her reputation was
wrong.
Well, it was wrong.
It was bullshit.
But there was a reputation there. And I think that's really interesting that I as an audience member sort of had this idea. It wasn't a big part of her character or anything like that. But then the fact that wasn't the case was just a really interesting little character wrinkle that I really appreciated.
Remember when, like, people in high school were called sluts and they'd slept with, like, one person?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Predictions, hopes, or concerns for future seasons of Lovecraft Country? As far as I'm aware, this has not been renewed for a season 2 yet, but I'm not sure about it.
I feel like it will be, right? It's got a lot of press.
No, it got a lot of press early. I'm not sure how well. Like the first episode or two, there was a lot of talk about it. Jordan Peele's attachment to it, Misha Green, etc.
Yep.
There was a lot to talk about. I'm not sure. I feel like a lot of people fell off the show as it went along. It's sort of like lost its audience a little bit. But that's just my impressions from like being online.
Yeah.
I can't say for sure. I feel like it probably will get a season 2 knowing HBO, but I wouldn't say for sure. Do you have any predictions, hopes, or concerns for a second season?
My hopes are they focus more on, well, here's the thing. So either they commit more to episode by episode kind of monster of the week type thing. Or if not, I hope that they can focus on, if it's going to be like an overarching thing, focus more on the interpersonal relationships so that that story would be more compelling.
As we said, the person that gave, with the robot arm, that gave Atticus the book will be D. I don't think that's even a question.
No.
That's what the show is just telling us. I'm really fascinated
unless
by
it's like a nega D or something, like who's like, which could be cool.
if any show is going to do it.
Robot armed girls just fighting to the death.
Every white person in the world being disconnected from magic. Magic is ours now, right? This idea of that I find fascinating. I'm also wondering though, how exactly does that work? Like, how is it calculated? Like, what percentage is it based on, like, the pigment level in your skin? Is it based on, like, if you're mixed race, what happens then? The idea of that is compelling an idea. I'm then trying to apply it to a real world
I think if
scenario. How do you do the math here? How white do you have to be excluded from magic versus how black?
Well, we'd be excluded.
You and I would be.
Definitely.
No doubt.
Look at us.
Look through us.
Yeah, exactly. Great questions.
I just found that. I just was like, great idea. But if I think about it for a second, what does that mean really? Like, how is that perpetuating calculated in the real world?
I guess it's just got to be like, if you're so racist and come from such a racist heritage that no one in your family has had sex with a person of color, but then you've got to factor in like rape and stuff, like of white men raping women of color,
which happens in this show. Well, this is Atticus's heritage.
Yeah.
His great-great-great-grandmother or whatever it was.
I'm assuming if you're 100% white, you're out.
100% white. How many people do you think are 100% white in the world?
I don't know. I really want to do, what's that?
23
and 17 and you and I together
and
holding
me.
Hands. Yeah, that one. I really want to do that. I don't know, Brad. I'm not a scientist.
I love that idea. I love like that they're introducing this idea that's like magic is ours now. I'm like, great. How? What's going to happen next season?
You want an episode about the logistics of that?
Kind of. If someone is 132 black because their great-great-great-grandmother or something like that happened to be, you know, whatever the reason is. It's like, do they get magic still even though they're a racist piece of shit? Like,
I think that's just the thing, though, is that you can't be 132th of anything. Either you, like, that is a part of you or it's not. So if it is a part of you,
sure. So it's got more to do with how you identify with your heritage, or the parts of your heritage that you try to like ignore or whatever it might
be. Okay, that's not what I was saying. But now you're saying that it's more of a conscious choice.
That's
okay.
What I'm trying to figure out. Like,
I guess that would make more sense.
That would, to me, would make the most sense. Obviously,
but does that
you can't just be a purely white person and say, I identify as a black person and you get magic.
So Rachel Dolezal or whatever the fuck her name is.
No, that wasn't what. You'd have to actually have some sort of genetic like inclusion, but you'd have to also be
acknowledging
in touch with that part of your heritage.
But what if through colonialism you do have somewhere down
and
the
you
line
don't know.
But you don't know.
That's what I mean. This is what
See,
I'm saying.
This is the whole paradox about Christianity that I could never understand as a kid. When my parents like, you know, as soon as you accept Jesus into your heart, then you're saved. But then like they can't really explain away all the people that died before Jesus or those that had never heard of him. I was like,
what
a horrific concept.
If you die at the age of 10 having never heard the name Jesus Christ,
you're
condemned
fucked.
To hell.
Yeah, I never understood it.
No, that's because
but,
it's
but then like
bullshit.
I feel like my parents would wave it away, being like, well, yes, would be like, oh, but if you know you die and you haven't heard of him, then you go to heaven and he gives you a chance to repent. Or I'm like, well, can't I then just like live whatever life I fucking want and then get to heaven and be like, so
yeah, why is that fair?
Yeah, it's not fair. Bullshit.
It's because it is bullshit.
That's why I stopped.
Because the answer is the answer is white people all hear about Jesus Christ and get an opportunity, and the others that don't matter. That's why it's racism.
Oh, full circle.
Also, one last thought, just going to next season. Time travel fucks everything. That's the bit I'm most worried about. Is like
I want now, that tattooed on my body, because I agree.
Now that we've introduced time travel and like other worlds, multi-dimensional aspects into this show, things are going to get complicated and messy real quick. And it's already.
Would you say that about Doctor Who, though? It doesn't have to.
No, but Doctor Who is more of a Scooby-Doo type show than it is a Lovecraft Country type
then
show, right?
That's what I'm hoping that that's what we become.
If that's what it does, and it just leans into like the separate stories that don't have to be connected by an overarching plot all the time, then it's not going to matter. But if you're going to then introduce that time travel or many worlds theory is going to be why Atticus comes back to life so we can have that character in the next season, blah, 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 it's just going to become a fucking mess like Lost very quickly, and it's going to, you know, be too dense to really be invested in the plot whatsoever.
I hope this show becomes like Doctor Who.
It's not going to.
No, I have hope. I'm definitely, if it gets to season two, I'm definitely coming back because I had a really good time.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Hunting Seasons. You can find more of what we do via our website, huntingseasonspodcast.com. Our logo comes from Sean Kirkpatrick, a.k.a. at Shawnee Boy Draws, and our theme song and bumpers from Lucas Heil of Birthday Loyalty Club. Find links to their work in our show notes. You can also find myself, Broderick Gordis, on Twitter at bgordes, B-G-O-R-D-E-S, Damask.
You can find me on the Twitter at maskymo, M-A-S-K-Y-M-O-O.
Next episode, we'll be back to discuss The Queen's Gambit Season 1. It is said to be a limited series on Netflix. I don't think they're planning on Season 2, but we'll still call it Season 1 just because.
Sure.
In the meantime, thank you again for listening. It's good to be back doing this in person. We will see you next time. Bye for now.
Bye. Good night, everybody. And so,